This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Odyssey. Your Radio Doctor does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, products, physicians, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on Your Radio Doctor. Always consult your own physician. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, WPHT HD, WOGL, HD3, Philadelphia. From the Cherry Hill Volvo Studios, where relationships matter. Always live on the free Odyssey app. It's time for the Delaware Valley's first radio doctor.
On call every Saturday afternoon at 5.
This is Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie. Presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
Listen, 7 months or 10 months is an absolutely exceptionally short time frame to produce this vaccine.
Your health determines your life, your longevity, and your happiness. Let your radio doctor lead the way with your medical education. Your radio doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie.
Good afternoon and welcome to Your Radio Doctor. I'm your host, Dr. Marianne Ritchie. It's June and next Sunday is Father's Day. So we're focusing on a very important topic for the men in your life, prostate cancer, screening, prevention, and the latest in therapy options. Our guest today is Dr. Patrick Gomela, who also has a master's in public health. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Urology at the Sidney Kimmel Medical College of Thomas Jefferson University. He also has a specialty in urologic oncology and is the co-director of the Prostate Cancer Focal Therapy Program, which is what we really want to hear about today. Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here to discuss this important topic for all the important men in your life.
Well, it's super special for me because I, in the past, had a very handsome, smart, wonderful doctor named Dr. Lenny Gomela, who happens to be your relative, your daddy, and he must be so proud of you that you're in the same field. So I'm really excited to have you today, Patrick. So let's remind our listeners what the prostate gland is, its job, and where it's located.
Yeah, the prostate is a walnut-sized gland that sits in the pelvis. It is right below the bladder, and most people don't realize when you urinate through your prostate. Its primary function is the support of really fluid that nourishes and transports sperm and the seminal fluid and the ejaculate. And that's its main function, along with secondarily, it does help men be continent as well, maintain urinary function as part of the internal sphincter.
And I guess the opposite is true, too, because if your prostate becomes enlarged with time, many men have an enlarged prostate, that might make you urinate more frequently. So it makes sense after you explain where it sits kind of under the bladder. So prostate cancer, we see that it's very common in men. And how common is it? And what are the risk factors?
Yeah, prostate cancer is actually very common. It is the most common solid organ cancer that afflicts men in the United States, skin cancers being the most common cancer overall. But it's actually the second leading cause of death in men in the United States behind lung cancer. The primary risk factors, there are several. The primary ones are age and family history. So the older a man gets, the greater likelihood of the diagnosis of prostate cancer. And certainly family history with the first degree relative being afflicted with prostate cancer being the largest risk factor. There are some additional risk factors just to mention. Genetics are one of them. That plays along with family history. So genetics and prostate cancer is really a recent phenomenon with lots of implicated germline mutations increasing a patient's risk for not only the cancer, but a more aggressive form of that cancer. These are mostly DNA damage repair genes, with the most common ones associated being the BRCA genes, which most of you are probably familiar with for breast cancer. Additionally, African-American men are diagnosed at higher rates and with more aggressive disease. A lot of theories on why that may be, access to care, genetics, but it's certainly a known phenomenon. In terms of modifiable risk factors, with everyone always asks me, there haven't been huge bombshells for prostate cancer and modifiable risks. But as you can imagine, they're implicated in a lot. Obesity and tobacco use are two big ones that are modifiable risk factors. And for a dietary standpoint, there has been some implication in dairy intake, believe it or not, unclear why that is. But the best recommendation I give my patients for those is really healthy diet and exercise and stopping tobacco use if you use it, because there's not only positive impacts on prostate cancer risk, but also on other health metrics, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, et cetera.
Sure. So none of these are clearly implicated, say obesity. We know that, say, in breast cancer, it leads to inflammation and changes in the breast tissue and may bump the risk. And, well, actually, I guess estrogen is made in fatty tissue after menopause, but obesity is just not our friend, as you already suggested. How about Agent Orange and arsenic? They're probably more clearly linked, or no?
They are. Those are two sort of environmental factors and factors for men and other service members in the military who may have been exposed to Agent Orange associated. You know, arsenic is not a nice thing in many capacities. Agent Orange has been implicated in many cancers, but prostate cancer is one of them. So if you have exposure to that during the Vietnam War, it's something you want to discuss with your urologist or primary care doctor.
Mm-hmm. And it would be interesting to see how this plays out, but maybe NSAIDs, meaning non-steroidal pain relievers like ibuprofen, etc., may decrease risk. Statins may be protective. We don't know, so we're not going to say that. Don't start taking ibuprofen because you'll get stomach ulcers and might not help the prostate anyway. But just interesting, time will tell us. But I thought it was interesting, too, that coffee may decrease death from prostate cancer. Again, these are all theories, and wouldn't it be great if we could drink coffee and decrease our risk for certain cancers? I guess food for thought. So screening, because we all know, and as you mentioned, BRCA, if the BRCA1 or 2 mutation is in your family line, or let's say it hasn't been identified per se, but there's male breast cancer in your family tree, or somebody had breast cancer before age 50, there are signals that, hey, you all might, or, you know, the patient at hand might get tested for BRCA. And if they have it, then you'd be tested. Tell us about the screening and where we are with that, if you would.
Yeah, screening is a big challenge, and it's been a hot topic for prostate cancer over the last decade. And I just want to sort of comment on what is meant by a screening test. And what it means is taking an asymptomatic member of the population and putting him through a test for the goal of reducing some outcome. Now, the challenge is, asymptomatic is true screening. If patients, however, are symptomatic, we have to keep in mind that sort of changes it. That changes the whole ball game, because now you're no longer screening the patient, you're testing the patient for a potential reason for their symptoms. So PSA is the primary test we use to screen for prostate cancer. It's a blood test. It was originally developed in the 1980s to help with the management of prostate cancer. And then in 1994, it was approved by the FDA for screening of prostate cancer, and has really sort of allowed our ability to detect cancer at much earlier, an earlier time period than we were before the approval of that test. Now, some patients are most concerned with the digital rectal exam component of the prostate cancer screening, which has been done much more commonly in the past. I will tell you that rectal exam as a standalone test is probably not beneficial. However, we as urologists, especially urologic oncologists, do think that, and it's shown that in patients with elevated PSA and an experienced hand, a rectal exam is a very important part of the staging and the screening for recommendations for further workup.
And I guess what makes it hard too, Patrick, what I'm learning from our discussion and further reading and what I knew before, is that prostate cancer really is often so slowly growing that a lot of times undiagnosed prostate cancer is found at autopsy. So how do we approach, what's the percentage of people who die from prostate cancer? Isn't it a very small percentage of those who get prostate cancer?
Yeah, I mean, the survival rates, if you look at overall survival rates, especially five-year survival rates, they're close to 99% in SEER data. You know, the likelihood of dying from prostate cancer is very, very low. And that brings in the challenge, as you mentioned, of screening, is we want to screen the patients and put them through testing that is going to help them and not put them through unnecessary testing and anxiety that they may not benefit from, especially if they don't live long enough to benefit from those tests.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, anxiety is such an important thing because when we talk about a screening test, we want to test people who have no symptoms, no pain, no bleeding, no trouble with passing their urine or anything that would be a red flag. But a really great screening test is one that's very specific. It always, you know, an elevated PSA always means prostate cancer, not the case. It can be with an inflamed prostate or other conditions. And so an elevated PSA will raise your anxiety, but not necessarily mean cancer, right? And the other thing is it specific and is it sensitive? How often does it pick up the enemy we're looking for?
Yeah, you bring up a very good point, which is challenging. As you mentioned, an ideal sort of gold standard screening test is both 100% specific and 100% sensitive, meaning all positive tests are positive and all negative tests are negative. But that's not really reality, and it's associated with prevalence of disease, and not to get into epidemiology and statistical principles. But here's the challenge. The overall sensitivity for asymptomatic screening is about 10 to 35%, and that's mm-hmm. taking the population without symptoms. So what does that mean? That means, you know, 65 to 90% of people, the majority of people with an elevated PSA do not go on to be diagnosed with prostate cancer. And that's because it's elevated for other benign reasons, as you mentioned. However, for symptomatic patients, the sensitivity is much, much higher. We're talking about in some series 80 to 90% sensitivity in patients with symptoms, though the specificity remains low. So it's still one of those tests that if it's elevated, it typically requires further workup before a diagnosis is made.
So we talked about people who might be at increased risk. Our listeners are familiar with the BRCA gene. We've talked several times about the Lynch syndrome that's related to colorectal cancer in younger patients. And so if people hear that, they might be asked to start at a younger age. So if the average person at average risk starts at about 50, if there's BRCA in your tree or Lynch syndrome, maybe it start at 40. What about, we mentioned African-American males, might they start younger? Or let's say a patient has a family history of a first degree relative, meaning a dad or a brother that got prostate before age 65, would they start at a younger age?
You bring up a very good point. We have updated our screening guidelines. There's different organizations that update the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. Our American Urologic Society does as well. But we've actually updated these. So now we're recommending starting screening at age 45 for men at average risk. Mm. So everyone should get a baseline test at age 45. It's a little bit younger than we recommended in the past. And that's because we have additional risk stratification tools available now, which we'll talk about later. For African-American men, they should be treated the same as first-degree relatives and those with known germline mutations. We typically talk about starting screening at age 40. And then we typically, depending on what the PSA shows, we have altered. It used to be a PSA every year. And for men with very, very low PSAs, we talk about screening intervals every 2 to 4 years. For higher risk patients and normal PSAs, every 1 to 2 years. And then, as we'll get into the details later, if your PSA is above 3 or age-dependent normals, we typically talk about additional risk stratification for biopsy decision.
And Patrick, again, for our listeners, an elevated PSA, don't jump to conclusions. It can be BPH, an enlarged prostate. It can be a recent bacterial infection called prostatitis, or even a recent exam that involves an instrument in the urethra. So you're not going to jump at the first elevated PSA. You're going to look at it again a little more closely. And let's take a little break, and we'll be back with prostate cancer and Dr. Patrick Gomela.
Thanks for listening to Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, exclusively presented by Independence Blue Cross. If you have a question for the medical mailbag, just send a note to doctor@yourradiodoctor.net.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
So we're here with Dr. Patrick Gamilla from Jefferson University Hospital's Department of Urology. Patrick, we're talking about prostate cancer. It's common. And one of the main causes of cancer death, second to lung cancer in men. And screening, wouldn't it be great if screening were perfect? It's not. And so we want to screen and test those patients at increased risk without subjecting them to unnecessary tests or tests that could harm them. That's the goal of any good screening test. If a person has an elevated PSA, what do you pursue next? Do you go right to a biopsy or something in between?
Yeah, so interestingly, as I mentioned earlier, when the FDA approved PSA for screening in 1994, we saw like 1,000% increase in the diagnoses of prostate cancer. And while it took about 10 years, we did notice a slight reduction in prostate cancer mortality, around 25 to 35%. Certainly with the number of cancers we were picking up, we would have predicted a much greater impact on mortality and overall survival, but we didn't. And why is that? Because many patients are diagnosed with a low-risk, indolent form of prostate cancer that may not require treatment. So what's revolutionized prostate cancer therapies and treatment and diagnosis is additional risk stratification tools we have. So if a patient sees me with an elevated PSA, I typically confirm that with a repeat test to ensure that it remains elevated, because not a good portion of the time, if you recheck it, it comes back down to a level that's very normal and appropriate. So for men that we're proceeding with the next step, we have additional biomarker tests, as well as something called multiparametric prostate MRI. And multiparametric prostate MRI has really, I think, been one of the biggest positives that have come out of research into prostate cancer. And that's for a very particular reason. Multiparametric MRI took a disease that we weren't able to image well and made a disease that we were able to image well. So now we've had multiple randomized trials that have been published that have shown that a pre-biopsy MRI is beneficial. It can allow us to avoid biopsy in certain men who have a very low risk. It also allows us at time of biopsy to make our biopsy better. So we can do a targeted fusion biopsy, and it's been shown in multiple different large series to reduce the risk of diagnosis of clinically insignificant cancer while increasing our diagnosis of cancers that may need to be treated in those men. Additionally, we've had some additional biomarker tests, both urine and blood tests that we use, because MRIs, you know, from a healthcare utilization standpoint are quite expensive and time intensive. So we do have some additional urine and blood-based biomarker tests that have, some of them have extremely high negative predictive values, especially in the previous negative biopsy space. So some patients can get a urine test sent to their house or done in the office that can essentially rule out with 94 to 99% negative predictive value a risk of a cancer. So in those cases...
So just for our listeners, sorry for interrupting, a negative predictive value means you're not going to be fooled in the wrong direction. The answer you get is not incorrect.
Correct. So in those men, the point of having this conversation is that we don't necessarily biopsy every man at this point. In the late 90s, if your PSA was elevated, you'd get a biopsy. That's no longer the case. So don't let a fear of potential biopsy prevent you from getting follow-up for elevated PSA.
So I guess the big message here is we've come so far with the help of, as you say, other than blood tests called the PSA, prostate-specific antigen, there are other blood tests. There are urine tests now that really help narrow down, is this real or Memorex? Is the PSA elevated because the prostate's a little bit enlarged, or the person had a recent instrument exam and prostate made a little smaller or some tissue removed? or is it cancer? And an MRI, right, it's no day at the beach, but there's no radiation involved. And if it gives us better imaging, we can look at certain images that if a growth has clear margins or a certain shape, we're going to say, we can take a chance on this and follow with blood tests instead of putting a needle that can cause side effects, right? So avoiding biopsy when we can. And when we do biopsy, not we, I'm not a urologist, but when you do biopsy, you take tissues from what I understand, take tissue from two areas of the tumor and grade them on how irregular or abnormal the cells look. And if you give each one a score, you combine them, and that's the Gleason score, which is another metric for you to talk to the patient and help decide what to do next, yes?
Correct. Yeah, we typically biopsy, and we have a few different biopsy approaches, both transrectal and transperineal approaches. But essentially, if you have a MRI target, you could do a targeted biopsy of that area, and then we typically combine it with a systematic template biopsy. And the pathologists take that, and you know, most cancers are graded by nuclear atypia, but prostate cancer is graded by glandular architecture in the prostate gland. And they assign, as you mentioned, the Gleason score. Now, the Gleason score is combined with a primary pattern and a secondary pattern to grade the overall Gleason pattern. It's a little bit confusing if you're not used to seeing it all the time, so we've tried to simplify it in the Gleason grade groups. So cancer can be graded from grade group 1, which is the lowest of low-risk prostate cancers, which some in our field are arguing we should no longer label cancer because it's so indolent, all the way up to grade group 5, which is considered the most aggressive form of prostate cancer that we see.
Mm-hmm. So you like to avoid treatment in early stage prostate cancer because, as we say, in a lot of men, the prostate cancer will live longer than the patient does. They'll die from some other cause. So why put them through the side effects of the testing or the treatment if it's just going to sit and smolder? Because am I right? Is it a number less than 3%, fewer than 3% of all men with prostate cancer die from it?
Yeah, I mean, as we mentioned earlier, long-term follow-up, and we have now some randomized trial data that comes out that, again, overall survival from prostate cancer is 99% for localized disease.
And we have to think about it. Yeah, because if the therapy is aggressive, which I guess back in the day before we had these other tools like the urine tests and additional blood tests and MRI, aggressive therapy can have long-lasting side effects like impotence or difficulty with continence of urine, bowel dysfunction. So you started to talk about how you stratify risk. And there are three categories, and you love to focus on the intermediate risk. So let's talk about that, the stratifications of risk, if we could.
Yeah, so we risk stratify patients at diagnosis. It's primarily based on PSA levels, primary biopsy pathology, and we put them into several buckets. Very low risk, intermediate risk, high risk, and very high risk. Intermediate risk is also separated into favorable and unfavorable intermediate risk. Essentially, we really decide not only just on the risk classification, but also a patient's age, their medical comorbidities, what treatment they may benefit from. So as you mentioned, very low and low-risk prostate cancers, the vast majority of those patients should at least start with a strategy called active surveillance with delayed intervention. That's for those indolent cancers that may not need to be treated. Now, it doesn't mean that every man that starts on active surveillance is going to be on active surveillance forever, but we've had patients where I trained at the NCI who've been on active surveillance for 15 years and greater. And, you know, it's a great approach to spare men the side effects of whole radical treatment that may not need it. Now, the high-risk group and the very high-risk group, especially if they are expected to live long enough, most certainly should likely get a radical therapy like surgery or radiation. Sort of the battleground is the intermediate risk population, where it's unclear at this point. Some patients are perfectly safe in the intermediate risk group following a course of active surveillance. while others have a higher risk of progression and needing additional therapy. So we're still actively working on additional ways to figure out which one of those patients can do what. But as we'll talk about, I think, in the next segment, there's an exciting option available for those patients, which involves something called focal therapy.
Mm-hmm. So to reiterate, there are some patients who are at very low or low risk, and active surveillance means you're going to see them periodically and do blood tests, maybe urine tests, and it's non-invasive, maybe an MRI. But for the most part, watch and wait and hope that it just stays quiet and doesn't, and that the if it turns to cancer, it's long after the person goes to heaven. Then the high risk, we're going to talk about how you decide between radiation surgery, in general terms, I guess, and your focus is focal therapy, your new baby. And if you spend time at the National Cancer Institute, boy, what a rich exposure you had to the latest and greatest. It's probably part of where the guidelines are made. And this is really a new territory, right, that we're going to do focal therapy because we want to maximize the potential to erase the cancer and minimize the side effects to the patient. Yes, a good way to say it?
Correct. That's a really great way to say that.
Mm-hmm. So for high-risk patients, very briefly, how do you decide whether to use radiation therapy or go right to surgery? I guess it depends on the person's age and you have the patient involved in the decision-making as well.
Correct. This is very, as we use the term, I haven't actually said it yet, which I'm surprised, shared decision-making. Gone are the days of paternalistic medicine where you came in and the doctor said, this is what you're going to do, and there's no point of discussion. So I have these conversations daily, both for screening decisions and treatment decisions in terms of age and comorbidities. I keep going back to age and comorbidities because, again, you want to put someone through a treatment that has significant side effects and risks who are going to benefit from that. So for high and very high risk, we typically say surgery and radiation, whole gland treatments. From what we know right now, surgery and radiation for cancer control are equivalent. So whether you have surgery or radiation, they're going to treat your cancer equally well. However, they each have different risks involved. They each have different treatment side effects and treatment courses. Okay, and so really it comes down, a lot of it comes down to age. We tend to shy away from radiation in the younger patients, say less than 60 to 65. And tend to prefer more surgery in those patients who are going to go surgery. While patients over 70 to 75, well, certainly we operate on them all the time. It's sort of also a very good case for radiation. As we mentioned, shared decision making is the name of the game where we have these conversations. And at the end of the day, the patient with the cancer decides what course of action he feels is best for him.
So just to reiterate, in younger men, we don't like to use radiation because in a small percent, younger meaning under age 50, they're at risk, although small, of developing a secondary cancer of the bladder or the rectum years later. And I, as a GI doc, if a person does choose radiation, the effect of the radiation can alter the lining of the rectum, and they can have really big problems with rectal bleeding. But as you explained the other day, there are ways to protect that tissue around. We want to get the cancer and not the healthy tissue around it, including the rest of the prostate or the rectum or anything else in the pelvis. And you use what's called a spacer now to kind of shield that healthy tissue. So that's certainly reassuring because I haven't seen it for a number of years, but these poor people would end up with this bleeding a month later, 5 years later, 10 years, whenever it decided to light up. I have another important question about pre-surgery that we'll hold till the next segment. Let's stay tuned and hear about your real champion this week. And now for your real champion, I call this segment, Rosie the Riveter Goes for Gold. Mae Cryer will tell you, I'm not a women's libber, I'm an equal writer. Women are just as capable as men, and she proved that in her role as Rosie the Riveter during World War II. Rosie the Riveter, one of the most famous icons in American history, the star of the campaign which called on American women to join the workforce to replace the men who were enlisted in the armed services. But the famous image didn't tell the story of one woman named Rosie. It's about the millions of women who joined the war effort. May grew up on a farm in North Dakota during the Great Depression. Her grandfather settled there because of the Homestead Act, so she considers herself part of a pioneer family. It was 1943. At age 17, May set out on her own adventure. With sister Loyola and friend Kathy, they moved to Seattle, lived in a boarding house, and found work at Boeing. Cryer said, "When the war came, every man, woman, and child dropped what they were doing. We all pulled together. We all helped. We did it to save our country." She quickly learned how to drill, work with sheet metal, finally became a riveter, and stayed through the war, helping fellow Rosies make over 6,000 B-17 and B-29 bombers. She married a sailor she met on the dance floor at a USO canteen, and they returned to Pennsylvania to raise their family. She speaks of him fondly and shares that he died at age 93, just before their 70th wedding anniversary. Decades ago, May began a letter-writing campaign to newspapers, veterans organizations, TV stations, to promote a national Rosie the Riveter Day to recognize the contributions of all the American women who helped to fight against Hitler. In early 2000, her story was covered by a local newspaper, and then the idea took flight. By 2017, March 21 would become the official annual Rosie the Riveter Day. By some sweet coincidence, March 21st is May's birthday. Well, her work led to another sweet coincidence when Congress announced a plan for a Congressional Medal of Honor for all the Rosaries, announced in 2020 on September 11, another day in our history marked with sacrifice. May has kept the legacy of Rosie alive by making red polka dot bandanas, similar to the one seen in the poster from 1942. When COVID arrived, she began working on a new war front. She used the same fabric to make over 6,000 masks during the pandemic. In fact, Boeing, May's former employer, sent a mission to space that included Rosie the Rocketeer, a mannequin wearing a polka dot bandana and a mask with a message from May that said, "Rosie the Rocketeer, to the moon and the stars." Because as a child of the Depression, her father would tell her stories about the moon and the stars as they sat by their potbelly stove. May has been on every TV network, given speeches all over the country and around the world, including at Normandy on the 75th anniversary of D-Day. During a ceremony, she placed a rose in the water at Omaha Beach, where so much blood was shed. She even kissed an astronaut who walked on the moon. She's received letters from every U.S. president since Bill Clinton, met several of them. She's been recognized with countless awards, spoken on Meet the Press, met war heroes like John McCain, and represented the Rosies even at a ceremony in the Netherlands. She was also recognized at the 80th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, when she was especially moved to sit with the veterans. "Many important people have told me that if it hadn't been for the women, we may have lost the war," she reminisces. After more than 50 years on her quest, on April 10 of this year, more than 24 Rosies from around the country were honored for their contributions with the Congressional Gold Medal. And May Cryer accepted that medal on behalf of all the Rosies. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson presented the award along with five other members of Congress and applauded the women who used their talents for the good of our nation. The Congressional Gold Medal is the highest honor that can be presented to a civilian, and fewer than 200 gold medals have been awarded in our country's history. People have asked May if she's going to write a book, and she says, "I'm too busy." Now at age 98, a great-great-grandmother of three, this past week, she returned to Normandy for the 80th anniversary of D-Day on June 6. May says, "I love people. People today need to remember to respect each other. I was born happy, healthy, and vital, and I plan to keep going. I tell my friends, get out of that rocking chair and keep going." And we know her work isn't done. Her next goal? A Rosie the Riveter statue at the World War II Memorial. It made me think of Rosie with her sleeve pulled up, showing her muscle and saying, "We can do it." We salute you, May Cryer, and all the Rosies who help protect and preserve our country. You're real champions.
Today's edition of Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross, can be enjoyed anytime, anywhere, at your convenience.
Just download the Odyssey app and search Your Radio Doctor. It's health education on demand.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, now Saturday afternoons at 5, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC.
And welcome back to Your Radio Doctor. We're so pleased to have Dr. Patrick Gomela as our guest today and learning so much about the latest screening techniques and therapies for prostate cancer. Patrick, we were talking about people at high risk and sitting down with the urologist and learning about the pluses and minuses of radiation therapy versus surgery. And of course, a person's age, you don't want to put an older person through big surgery if we can do radiation and kill the tumor and avoid invasive surgery. A younger person, you might not want them to deal with the effects of radiation long term. So all of those good sense thoughts. If a patient has an enlarged prostate when their probable cancer is found, do you ever perform prostate reduction or a TURP, remove some of the prostate tissue before you go to the surgery or radiation therapy?
So typically, since surgery, we're removing the whole prostate. We typically don't, though I will say that we counsel patients who have very large prostates that their risk of urinary incontinence is a little bit higher than someone with, say, an average-sized prostate. Though for radiation therapy, especially in someone who's very symptomatic from a urinary standpoint, if the prostate's large enough, now many men getting radiation have high-risk disease, and they get hormone therapy in combination with their radiation treatments, which reduce the prostate size. But prostate reduction TURP procedures are very challenging and very fraught with complications doing it after radiation. So if there's a patient who's very symptomatic from a urinary standpoint and they're proceeding with radiation and have a very large prostate, we may take them and do a something called a channel TURP, a channel transurethral resection of the prostate, to basically reduce their likelihood of significant urinary issues both during and after radiation.
So these are things that make perfect sense when you explain them so clearly. And your project right now, something you're really concentrating on, is focal therapy, because it's a little bit easier to make a decision if somebody's at low risk. It's a little more obvious. You're going to become more radical in your choice with high risk. It's that intermediate where you want to help the person, you want to eliminate the cancer and decrease their side effects short and long term. So let's hear about Jefferson's fantastic focal therapy center and your leading the way with that. And tell us what these focal therapy options are, if you would.
Yeah, this is something we're really excited about. Focal therapy has been very commonly used overseas in Europe and in Australia. But like many things, it takes a while for things to make it to the United States. Focal therapy was somewhat taboo about 15, 20 years ago. A lot of patients would go overseas and pay out of pocket to have these sort of stealthy procedures in the Caribbean. But thankfully now, as a field, we've embraced this. And at Jefferson, we recently launched our prostate cancer focal therapy program. This is in coordination with both the university and the Sydney Kimmel Cancer Center. And I just have to throw a shout out for our Sydney Kimmel Cancer Center, which just received a comprehensive cancer center designation from the NCI after their most recent site review, which we're all very excited about. But our program is very unique in the Philadelphia region because we have several focal therapy techniques available to us, and we can really tailor the approach to the specific patient and tumor location. So there are about 7 or 10 different focal therapy techniques out there described. The ones we have available right now at our institution are something called HIFU, high intensity focused ultrasounds, cryotherapy, and something called irreversible electroporation. I'll briefly touch base. It's hard to get into all the nitty-gritty details in a short time period, but the cornerstone of our program is our Focal One unit, which is a robotic HIFU platform. It is the most advanced HIFU platform available and the only one available in the Philadelphia region right now. It combines high-fidelity ultrasound and MRI fusion technology for us to be really able to target MRI-visible cancers with extreme accuracy. And this approach is essentially using a transrectal probe and focused energy via an ultrasound probe to induce cell death by heating the tissues to a really high temperature. The opposite in terms of a thermal technique is cryoablation. Cryoablation is performed with a rectal ultrasound probe, but needles are placed transperineally into the prostate, into the target tissues, and using basically physics, something called the Joule-Thompson effect. As argon gas expands, it rapidly cools. So we use argon gas to create ice balls, which leads to cell death, and then helium to thaw the tissues. And the final technique that we have available right now is something called irreversible electroporation, which essentially uses transperineally placed needles and a high voltage direct current delivered between those two needles to induce permanent pores in the cell membranes, which lead to apoptosis and cell death.
So for a listener to picture this, HIFU or high intensity focused ultrasound, use a probe, a small probe that goes through the rectum, and then you can point it right at the prostate, and high foci or ultrasound heats and kills the cancer cells. In the other two options, cryoablation, cryo meaning cold, you use argon gas that and that gets very cold and causes ice balls, and then the helium. How does the helium work again?
Helium is just the opposite effect of the argon. So when helium expands, it lowers the temperature rapidly. And the data shows that if you rapidly cool the tissues and actively thaw the tissues, you get a more effective treatment effect on the cells.
But you mentioned that involves the cryotherapy and the third, the nanoknife, putting a needle through the perineum. So for people who don't know what that is, there's a space of tissue between the urethra or the where you urinate and your rectum. And so it's through that area of tissue where the needle's inserted, and you use a probe in the rectum to tell you where to go. I mean, we're not trying to scare people, but I think if they realize how carefully this is done and how ingenious it is, really, it really helps you narrow down your focus for the therapy, and it's really specified. And that's how you can avoid side effects, because you're targeting, and trying to protect the normal tissue that shouldn't be affected. You know, you don't want to freeze or send electrical pulses to normal tissue.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, the goal of the focal therapy is, as you mentioned, a focal tissue destruction. So the idea with our imaging visible lesions and our biopsy proven areas, we could target those with very high accuracy and treat that area and a smaller area around the tissue, sparing the vast majority of the prostate gland, the neurovascular bundles, the apex of the prostate, where the urethral sphincter is, with the goal of providing a treatment for that cancer, but minimizing those quality of life impactful side effects of whole gland radical treatment that we discussed earlier.
Now, you mentioned earlier, if a person has high risk, they have prostate cancer, and we have to do a radical decision, either treat the whole prostate with radiation or remove the whole prostate with surgery. We're learning that no matter which of those you choose, the recurrence rate is the same. They both do well. How do you make a decision which focal therapy to use? And are they all about the same in terms of prognosis, that they keep the person safe regardless of one of those three, or as you say, 10, the three you're looking at?
Yeah, so we do not have any head-to-head randomized trial data comparing each of these modalities against each other. We do have some exciting data that was just presented at our AUA, American Urological Association meeting, which was called the HIFI trial, which looked at radical prostatectomy and HIFU with the Focal One device. It was a non-inferiority trial. And essentially, it was, I mean, it was great. At 30 months, the salvage therapy-free survival rate was actually higher in the HIFU arm, meaning more people in the HIFU arm did not go on to needing additional treatments than did the radical prostatectomy patients. Okay, it was about a 4 to 5% risk reduction. But the more important thing is the majority of those patients in that trial who got HIFU were about 10 years older. And when you compared the two groups, quality of life was the same despite the HIFU patients being 10 years older, and the pad-free continence rate was much, much higher in the patients who underwent focal therapy, despite the fact that they were 10 years older than the patients who underwent surgery. So it's exciting, and it provides some additional data to show that the treatment is very effective in the properly selected man and can allow for a treatment approach that really reduces those harmful quality of life side effects.
Are the side effects pretty similar in any of the three choices we're discussing, either high-intensity ultrasound with the freezing techniques or the nano knife, that small needles, again, in that tissue between where you urinate and past your bowel movements, the rectum, small needles deliver electrical pulses that destroy cancer cells. Are the side effects pretty similar among the three choices?
Yeah, I'll be honest. A lot of them are very overlap. You know, we didn't mention this, but these all these approaches are outpatient procedures, so they're the same day surgeries that you come in. They all take about 2 hours. You know, for to do the procedure, 2 hours or less. The majority of side effects are some short term urinary frequency and urgency, just from the
swelling.
Prostate swelling and tissue changes that can happen. So most men have a catheter in place for about a week. Especially with HIFU, there could be a lot of prostate swelling. So we give you time for the prostate swelling to reduce before we remove that catheter. But really, the side effects are short term. So it's not unlike getting a benign prostate reduction procedure like the TURP. That there are some increased urinary frequency and urgency kind of side effects. There, just like any procedures, there are some very, very rare significant side effects, but the rates of things of those are less than 1%. Things like fistulas and the like are extremely, extremely rare in all these studies.
Which is a kind of scar that connects two areas that should be connected. It's like a new unwelcome bridge. So then how do you decide which suggestion or which path a certain person should take?
A lot of it has to do with the prostate size, prostate anatomy, and tumor location. So
location, yeah, I didn't think of that.
Yeah, because the HIFU energy is delivered through a rectal probe, there is a size limitation. If you have a really large prostate or a lesion that's very high up in the prostate, HIFU is not the best approach for that. HIFU is best for the posterior lesions. So if you have an anterior lesion or a larger prostate or an apical lesion, we prefer to do, my preference would be to do IRE in that case, the irreversible electroporation, given there's some theoretical benefits that the cellular architecture, you know, sort of the extracellular membrane is preserved while the cancer cells are destroyed. So
gotcha.
It's primarily tumor location and prostate size that guide our treatment choices.
So if the prostate is the size of a walnut, we say, if the lesion is in the back, close to the rectum, obviously we're going to go with a nice, easy, put the ultrasound probe into the rectum and you're easier to reach the target. But if it's at the top of the walnut or toward the front of the body, you're going to go with the tiny needles that go through the perineum. And how about, they're done as outpatients, anesthesia, is it general or what we use for colonoscopy?
Yes, all these require, as you can imagine, with a imaging guided approach, very still, no movements. So everything is done under general anesthesia.
Which is good for people to know because they don't want to be afraid of waking up or being uncomfortable during the exam, which sounds really to be like the level of colonoscopy, which is a fun exam. I mean, we know that all colonoscopies are pain-free. Minor swelling, maybe where you insert the needles, localized soreness, but pretty much minimal, if any, effect on urinary function, bowel function, or sexual function. Pretty safe to say.
Correct. Especially long, at 6 to 12 months after the those impacts on function are minimal.
And you'd expect it to happen within that amount of time. That's incredible. Let's take a little break, and when we come back, we'll have our wrap-up with Dr. Patrick Gamella from Jefferson.
Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie is presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Final segment of Your Radio Doctor, which we call Your Weekly Prescription. We have a wrap-up from Dr. Patrick Gamella from Urology at Jefferson University Hospital. Patrick, we've learned so much from listening. What are some of the bullet points you would like to review from our three segments?
Yeah, I think just a quick review, you know, prostate cancer is out there. 1 in 6 to 8 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer in their lifetime. So chances are you know a man either personally or at least who you work with who may be diagnosed with cancer. So it is a very treatable condition. We have improved our diagnostic and treatment pathways a huge amount over the last 20 years. To ensure that those men that will benefit from invasive procedures and biopsies are the only ones that should go through those techniques. That being said, prostate cancer is a complex disease, and what I mean by that is it's important to discuss with your urologist or primary care doctor your individual personal risk level. And if you are diagnosed with cancer, this is my plug. I am a huge proponent of multidisciplinary cancer care. This is a big decision. It's a big point in your life when you get the diagnosis of any cancer. So I want to stress the importance of multidisciplinary cancer care, which we at Jefferson really have been pioneers of. There's been a weekly multidisciplinary genitourinary cancer clinic that we have had at our cancer center since the late 90s. Where we meet as a group with radiology, medical oncology, pathology, urology, and review patients, see patients, and provide great treatment recommendations.
And the other great thing, you're collecting data on your success with these three therapies, sometimes more. And am I right? The high-intensity ultrasound is now being considered in use for endometriosis. And the NanoKnife, or the electroporation with the small needles that deliver electrical pulses, is starting to be considered for pancreatic cancer. So the overlap is going to be very important too. And it's fantastic to know that Jefferson has this center. So the Prostate Care Foundation and American Cancer Society are both good websites for people to check for more information.
Correct. I think Dr. Google is a challenge, and I caution anyone from just Googling things because you'll find a lot of information that isn't necessarily the best. But places like the Prostate Care Foundation and the American Cancer Society are good places for data-driven information on prostate cancer and treatment options that I recommend any patient or family member that has a patient, a family member is diagnosed with cancer, use these websites as good resources. Mm-hmm.
And even as you say, you can't filter it yourself, but it helps you think of questions to ask your doctor. So Prostate Care Foundation or American Cancer Society is cancer.org. That's always easier to remember. I love that website. If a patient wants to see you, Patrick, how would they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so for any patient out there who's interested in a consultation with myself or any of my urologic cancer colleagues, specifically, I want to mention Dr. Adam Mathwali, who's a mentor of mine, also trained, is a senior partner of mine. We're the co-directors of our focal therapy program and do all of the focal therapy at Jefferson right now. The best place is, if you want, you can call 1-800-JEFF-NOW, which is our main appointment line, and ask for urology. Specifically for our multidisciplinary clinic is a great place to schedule an appointment. And if you also go to jeffersonhealth.org and search for urology, you're able to do some limited self-scheduling of appointments and also get further information on different treatment options and different physicians that we have working as in our department with us.
Dr. Patrick Gamella, that's one of the best interviews we've had. ever. It was so clearly done, and you make it so easy for people to reach out to you and read more for themselves. So I thank you for teaching us so much about prostate cancer prevention, screening, and the latest therapies. I hope you join us again soon with more information about your progress.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate sharing all the knowledge and experience.
Thanks for listening to your Radio Doctor every Saturday afternoon at 5 here on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. Listen again to any of our shows, Real Champions, on Audacy.com. That's AUDACY.com. You can listen to the show live on 1210 WPHT or live stream using Audacy.com. Then all of our shows are posted as podcasts on YourRadioDoctor.net, Audacy.com, and wherever you get your podcasts. A special thank you to our exclusive sponsor, Independence Blue Cross, and we enjoy our association with Helio.com, the medical information platform with the most current medical news and information. Visit Helio.com, great article from April 19th that describes urine tests that detect late prostate cancer, which might help avoid biopsies in some cases. Please send us stories of champions in your family, workplace, or communities, or let us know what medical topics you'd like us to cover. Write to me at info@yourradiodoctor.net, info@yourradiodoctor.net. And please continue to pray for peace in our world, our beloved country, our families, and each of our own hearts. This is Your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, wishing you a happy, healthy, and safe week with the ones you love. Always here to remind you that your health is your wealth.
Thanks for listening to Your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross. To contact Dr. Marianne and to listen to today's show as well as past shows, visit yourradiodoctor.com. This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Audacy. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.